From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR correspondents from around the globe. I'm Dee Dee Skanky. This week, we return to Pakistan's Swat Valley, where citizens are taking the law into their own hands. We also go to Congo for its 50th anniversary of independence, and we'll wrestle with a sumo wrestling scandal in Japan. But we start this week's podcast with a look back at the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Iraq marked the one-year anniversary of the withdrawal of U.S. troops from its cities on June 30th. By the end of this summer, only 50,000 U.S. troops will be left in the entire country, a country that now finds itself at a crossroads. While violence is down from the levels of 2006 and 2007, many Iraqis say the U.S. is leaving behind a nation that is at best a work in progress. NPR's Lourdes Garcia-Navarro reports from Baghdad.
Everyday convoys like this one are rolling out of Iraq, carrying the machinery of war. This is one of the largest and most complicated drawdowns in U.S. history, and one of the speediest. The message from America's politicians, military men, and diplomats is clear. The Iraq War, at least America's role in it, is over. U.S. forces are now assuming a training and advisory role. Bases are being handed over to Iraqis every week. General Jerry Cannon heads the detainee operation for the U.S. Come mid-July, the last U.S.-run prison will be given to the Iraqis.
We're very forthright with them. The end is near.
On Iraqi television yesterday, songs extolling Iraq's sovereignty played over and over to mark the one-year anniversary of the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq's cities. One begins, "Iraq, surely you will be powerful again. Your days and nights will be joyful again." But these days, people here are anything but. For the past few weeks, Iraqis have been demonstrating all over the country because of continuing power shortages. The water, roads, the hospitals, and the schools are also in a state of disrepair. It's been more than 7 years of bloody conflict. Tens of thousands of Iraqis have died. At least 4,400 U.S. service members have given their lives. Security is better if you use the benchmark of the worst years of the Civil War. General Michael Barbero is in charge of training Iraqi forces. He says over the past year, nationwide, security incidents have decreased over 45%.
Today we're talking about political issues, not security issues. I think it's a level of maturity and development of Iraq.
But Iraq is a country with little to show for the billions of dollars spent and the lives lost, says Iraqi politician Mahmoud Othman. 4 months after parliamentary elections, Iraq's fractious political parties are still negotiating over the formation of a government. It's an acrimonious and sectarian process. And Othman says the players seem to have little sense of anything other than their own narrow interests.
They are not in touch with the people, these people. You look at them, where they are living, they are isolated from people. That's why I don't think they are moving. They don't feel the responsibility.
He charges that the U.S. could act as an honest broker, but seems totally disengaged.
Obama administration, they want to get out of Iraq. They have exit strategy. It's very clear. They want to get out.
In an interview with NPR, U.S. Ambassador Christopher Hill says the troop withdrawal, a product of an agreement with the Iraqis, does not signify a lack of interest. But he adds the days when America would directly intervene in Iraq's political affairs are indeed over.
We need to be mindful of what is proper engagement. That is, for us to be acting in an inappropriate way, in a way that suggests that this is our decision and not the Iraqi decision.
But, says Mahmoud Othman, whatever form that long-term relationship takes, he fears that Iraq will be tainted by what the invasion and war have left behind.
I think it's a well said. And I think day and day you see it's more going towards being a failed state.
Lourdes Garcia-Navarro, NPR News, Baghdad.
The U.S. has largely shifted its attention and resources from Iraq to Afghanistan. But the new commanding officer there, General David Petraeus, is going to find key military projects unfinished and a crucial political process that's just beginning. NPR's Corey Flintoff reports from Kabul.
In the weeks before the scandal that cost him his job, General Stanley McChrystal wasn't exactly enjoying the prerogatives of being the top military commander in Afghanistan. Instead, he was scrambling to keep his counterinsurgency strategy on track. After a trip to Kandahar with Afghan President Hamid Karzai, McChrystal stood on the ramp of a cargo plane to talk to reporters. His first task was to express condolences
to the families and the comrades of all the Afghans who were murdered in the last week just in Kandahar.
The commander was drawing attention to the brutality of insurgent attacks on Afghan civilians, but he was also acknowledging that a key element of his counterinsurgency strategy, protecting the population, still isn't as good as it needs to be. Before McChrystal got into trouble for remarks made to a Rolling Stone magazine reporter, he raised eyebrows with the remark that a key NATO operation in southern Afghanistan, the effort to restore Afghan government control at Marja, had turned into a bleeding ulcer. By that, he meant that ongoing clashes with Taliban fighters and mounting coalition casualties were making the initial success of the Marja offensive look like a longer-term failure.
Well, I think the biggest lesson is that you have to manage expectations.
That's Marine Major General Richard Mills, whose command includes Marja. He says he and fellow commanders want to be sure their bosses have a realistic idea of how long their job will take. Managing expectations has become a mantra for commanders in the Kandahar area, where they routinely tell reporters not to expect a bang-up offensive, but a slow concentration of coalition troops, coupled with a surge in civilian efforts to strengthen the Afghan government. In Marja, the Marines closest to the fight say it's tough. One day last week, Lieutenant Colonel Brian Christmas, commander of the 3rd Battalion, 6th Marines, attended a memorial for one of his fallen men.
And we've had a couple of fights today, of which we've lost one Marine and one A&A, and then a wounded linguist. So, yeah, it's always tough when that happens.
An ANA is an Afghan National Army soldier. Despite the losses, Christmas says he's seeing progress, especially since local leaders are now willing to be seen cooperating with the Americans. Just 15 miles from Marja in the provincial capital, Lashkar Gah, life can seem almost normal. Off-duty Afghan soldiers hang out with their friends and compare motorcycles on the edge of a football stadium. This soldier declined to give his name because he's not authorized to talk with reporters. But from his perspective, at the bottom of the chain of command, he says he thinks the government is slowly gaining the trust of local people. He says it's hard to predict, but unless the Taliban lay down their arms and agree to join the government, it's going to take a long time to end this war. President Hamid Karzai has called repeatedly on the Taliban to reconcile with his government, but his spokesmen deny rumors that they're negotiating with the insurgent leadership. Still, no matter how well his forces do in Marja or Kandahar or in the northern and eastern provinces where violence is escalating, General Petraeus' mission may well depend on the political will and negotiating skill of a shaky Afghan government. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Kabul.
Last year, in Pakistan's Swat Valley, the Taliban hunted down people they said had violated their strict interpretation of Islam. Now, a year after the Pakistan army dislodged the Taliban, it's the citizens of Swat who've taken the law into their own hands with the help of the army. NPR's Julie McCarthy recently traveled to Swat and has this story on the harsh treatment being meted out to families of Taliban members and sympathizers.
Sami Ula opens the latch on the front door of his family house on the outskirts of Mingora, the main city in Swat Valley. But when he swings the door open, there is no house. There is only rubble and a cloud of noise and dust. Sledgehammers heaving, the next door neighbor rebuilds a retaining wall between his house, which was lightly damaged, and Sammy's, which was razed. Sammy now sleeps in a room where the family stabled their one cow and calf across the alleyway from his ruined home.
I don't want to visit this place, you know, again and again, because once I see it, my feelings are that of grief. And it is pushing me towards mental disturbance.
The 19-year-old engineering student blames the army for demolishing his home as a form of collective punishment for having a relative who joined the Taliban. Sammy admits that his older brother ran off with the militants 3 years ago, but says his father disowned him in 2007. He fingers a worn document officially stating so. Last month, he says, uniformed army personnel showed up to say the family had to vacate the premises, and the next day they were taken to a camp outside of SWAT. Sammy says an army representative dismissed his father's signed statement disowning his militant son.
And he said, these documents are not going to be of any help to you because now you have been moved to the camp and you would not come back from the camp unless and until you bring your brother and he surrenders to the army.
Sammy has been let out for exams and says he reports daily to the army. The army spokesman in SWAT denies that the military demolished Sammy's or anyone's home in a zeal to root out militant sympathizers. Major Mushtaq Khan suggests it was locals looking to avenge their losses under the Taliban's brief but brutal rule.
Might be some civil people, might be the people of those villages who have destroyed their houses, but they are not army. Army don't do it.
Nor does the army decide whom to expel, according to Major Khan. He says that is purely a local matter determined by community elders at a jirga or assembly in accordance with Pashtun culture and its consensus decision-making. To the extent the army is helping remove people that elders say should go, Major Khan says it's for their own good.
So you're saying this is a purely humanitarian gesture?
Yes, purely humanitarian gesture. The army which is providing to the people. Why not?
Inam Rahman heads the local citizens' council that recently banished Sami Ullah's and 34 other families on suspicion of being informants for the Taliban. Rahman says four of his closest friends have been killed in the past 2 months in attacks that suggest the work of Taliban remnants here. He says it was difficult to banish longtime neighbors, but the council acted in self-defense.
And the reason was that people were very, very angry, especially when the targeted killing started. We just expelled these limited number of families, and so that it could serve as an example.
It is against morality, against humanity.
SWAT human rights advocate Ziauddin Yousafzai says the tactic undermines the very law and order last summer's army offensive was designed to restore. And he says the groups like the Jirga that banished Sami's family are little more than rubber stamps for the army.
This policy was made by the army. Had there been an independent stance of the Jirga, they might have questioned it, that why are you just expelling the whole family?
Amnesty International Asia-Pacific Director Sam Zarifi says SWAT's ad hoc law enforcers in concert with the government are acting without any judicial process.
Collective punishment in which you destroy a community, destroy a family because of the alleged actions of a member of the family is a violation of obviously the most basic kind of human rights, which is that individuals have rights in and of themselves.
Zarifi says the policy of collectively punishing families is also fanning a culture of reprisals.
Because what we see is that these peace jirgas, in many cases, are simply carrying out old vendettas, old feuds.
Settling scores. Sami Ullah, meanwhile, returned to SWAT from Karachi today, where he was searching for his militant brother. He said the army urged him to go look there and told him to bring his brother back, dead or alive. Julie McCarthy, NPR News.
Coming up, Congolese celebrate their nation's 50th. And Japanese wrestle with a gambling scandal.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Dee Dee Skanky. 1960 marked the year that many African countries gained independence. They include the Democratic Republic of Congo, a former Belgian colony that turned 50 on June 30th. Congo has the resources to be one of the wealthiest countries in Africa. But instead it has lurched from rebellions and coups to dictatorship and civil war. NPR's Ophebia Quist-Arkton reports on a country still hoping to realize its potential.
Picture one of the most richly endowed countries on Earth, with its rainforests and endless deposits of diamonds, uranium and coltan, the mineral used to manufacture your cell phone and laptop. That's Congo. Yet this nation has little piped water and no reliable electricity supply for its 68 million people. On a ramshackle barge heading downriver from Mbandaka in the north to the capital Kinshasa, karate instructor Justin Ngbongbo marked his 50th birthday, complaining that neither he nor 50-year-old Congo had much to celebrate, and that annoyed him.
Oui, je suis fâché parce que il me reste presque rien.
Ngbongbo told me he was lucky to have a job, but he had a family to feed, and every day was a struggle. So what sort of legacy was that for future generations in Congo, he asked. Joseph Kabasele's Independence Cha-Cha, a song that was all the rage in Congo 50 years ago. Then the hopeful and newly independent nation straddling the heart of Africa was celebrating. But Congo got off to a troubled start. Within a year of independence, Patrice Lumumba, its first leader, was assassinated, reportedly with CIA involvement. Congo became a Cold War pawn. Under a kleptocratic dictatorship, Washington's ally, President Mobutu Sese Seko, looted state coffers. By the time Mobutu was driven out of power in 1997, Congo was an impoverished, underdeveloped giant, the size of Western Europe, but with barely 300 miles of paved road to its name. Mobutu's departure unleashed civil wars, which sucked in nine neighbors and claimed more than 5 million lives. Despite the presence of the world's biggest United Nations peacekeeping force, rebellions continue in eastern Congo, dubbed the rape capital of the world. In recent weeks, though, as Congo prepared to celebrate its 50th anniversary, strains of independence cha-cha are again floating around Kinshasa. And the sounds of construction filled the air while the shabby city was spruced up to welcome guests. Chinese labourers have given Kinshasa's once tree-lined June 30th boulevard a complete makeover. Congo's president, Joseph Kabila, came to power after his predecessor and father, Laurent Kabila, was assassinated in 2001. 4 years ago, Kabila won disputed elections, made Congo's development his priority, and signed a $9 billion agreement with China, whose economy is now fueled in part by Congo's minerals. The Congolese information minister, Lambert Mende Omalanga, insists the deal is a win-win.
We are selling our wealth to China in exchange of infrastructures, hospitals, schools, university, railways, roads. It is what our people need.
But many Congolese are struggling to survive and long for their country's moment of promise. These aging independence fighters gather to chant rallying cries dating back to the brief era, 50 years ago, when Belgian Congo threw off its colonial shackles and stood ready to become a leader in independent Africa. Disillusioned Congolese say that dream failed, and they hope for a brighter future. Ophebia Quist-Arkton, NPR News, Kinshasa.
Japan's national sport, sumo wrestling, has had some serious problems the last few years. There have been incidents of violent hazing and drug use, and the sport's popularity has been sagging. Now, sumo wrestling has been shaken again, this time by revelations of gambling and mob connections. The Japan Sumo Association said it may force 15 wrestlers and 14 club owners to sit out the next tournament, and a handful are facing expulsion. Lucy Kraft reports from Tokyo.
Dozens of sumo wrestlers and club owners, known as stable masters, have confessed involvement in illegal gambling. Sumo journalist Takayuki Watanabe says the worst offenders were 29 sumo wrestlers and officials who bet on baseball.
To wager on baseball, you need to know the game well, and you need plenty of cash. That excludes junior wrestlers because they don't earn salaries. So only the most talented, most popular wrestlers seen on TV are able to gamble on baseball. That's what's been so shocking.
In the last few years, scandal has become as much a part of sumo as loincloths and bulk-up diets. The legendary sport seemed to start its tailspin back in 2007 when a teenaged recruit was killed during a violent training session. Later, four wrestlers were fired for marijuana use. And then this year, one of the two reigning champions was forced to retire after a series of problems ending with a drunken brawl. That one-time sumo star, Asa Shoryu, was from Mongolia. This episode seemed to reinforce perceptions that the globalization of sumo was bringing down the sport. Sumo has come to be dominated by men from developing countries, those willing to endure the grueling regimen for a chance to become champions and multimillionaires. Sumo has always stood for more than just sport, though. It dates back at least 1,500 years and is part of the founding myth of Japan itself. Legend holds that the Japanese won their islands in a sumo bout of the gods. Jeff Kingston, director of Asian studies at Temple University Tokyo, says wrestlers are an impressive sight on Tokyo streets.
If you look at them walking around the streets with their flowing yukata and their wooden geta and they have their top knots, I mean, they do look like throwbacks to the past. And so they are sort of modern representations of traditional mores and virtues. And so, yeah, I do think the public holds them to a higher standard.
But this time, in the worst scandal to hit sumo in memory, there aren't any foreign suspects to blame, notes veteran sumo commentator Doreen Simmons.
Yes, it is a huge crisis. All the other problems that have surfaced recently were one-offs that could be treated as individual problems. This is the bedrock. This is the whole sumo association. I mean, not everybody by any means, but an awful lot of people, including major stable masters, some of the most successful men.
The details of the scandal involve a hairdresser who served as courier between wrestlers and yakuza, the Japanese mob that placed the bets. Hairdressers, who create the perfumed and oiled topknots that wrestlers wear, are a constant presence at sumo stables. One of the more outrageous allegations is that yakuza foot soldiers are able to get coveted front row seats to sumo tournaments and literally communicate with their pals in prison thanks to national TV, says journalist Watanabe of Japan's TBS TV network.
Convicts are allowed to watch sumo live on TV. The reason why mafioso want to sit close to the ring is to get on TV. Then their boss in prison can see that they're doing well, and they can demonstrate their loyalty.
Doreen Simmons says sumo and the yakuza have a long and complicated history.
As long as I've been following sumo, which is 35 years or so, there's been this fight against the yakuza, the gangsters, established crime. But, of course, the reason there's a fight is that there's a lot of money around, and that some of the oyakata and famous wrestlers are involved, always have been.
Rumors of match-fixing have swirled around sumo for years. The secretive and insular sumo association has never investigated these allegations. But Temple University's Jeff Kingston says the latest scandal is the most damning circumstantial evidence yet that yakuza have the leverage to force wrestlers to throw their matches.
Mob-linked gambling on baseball, which is illegal, is involving many people in the sumo world. So the fact that the yakuza and the sumo are now sitting uncomfortably close together in the media, I think, is raising suspicions.
While next month's tournament will proceed without some of its most talented wrestlers, the audience may be drastically reduced. Japan's NHK State Broadcasting Network has been deluged with angry letters from citizens demanding that it pull the plug on sumo programming. For NPR News, this is Lucy Kraft in Tokyo.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Dee Dee Skanky.